Ladies and gentlemen, before we begin, a disclaimer. Participation in this call is by express written invitation of the AHA only. Unauthorized participants and or any party that aids and abets such unauthorized participants may be subject to criminal and civil penalties under both state and federal law, including the Electronic Communication Privacy Act. Good day and welcome to the American Hospital Association Reduce Readmissions and Avoidable ED Visits, Advocate Healthcare's Medically Integrated Crisis Community Support Conference Call. Today's conference is being recorded. However, the Q&A session at the end of the conference will not be recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to today's speakers. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Operator. This is Rebecca Chicky, Director of the American Hospital Association's Section for Psychiatric and Substance Abuse Services. And it's my honor today to be joined by two esteemed colleagues in behavioral health, Sherry Rickhart, who is an LCSW. She is the Manager for Crisis, CL, First Access, MICCS, and Aftercare at Advocate Illinois Masonic Medical Center. And we are also joined by Dr. Shasti Swaminathan, who is the chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Advocate Illinois Masonic Medical Center in Chicago, Illinois. As the operator indicated, today's title is Reduce Readmissions and Avoidable ED Visits, Advocate Healthcare's Medically Integrated Crisis Community Support Program. This is one of a number of AHA's executive dialogue series on behavioral health care that we have offered over the past few years. Just a couple of housekeeping issues. If any of you have had a difficulty in accessing the PowerPoint online, you can find it, that is via the web tool, you can find it on AHA's website. It is at aha.org/psych, that's T-S-Y-C-H. Click on the title for today's webinar, and it will take you to the page where you can access the PowerPoint as well as Dr. Swaminathan's bio. One other thing, I encourage you as the presentation proceeds, if you have questions and you are using the online web tool, there is a feature there that allows you to submit questions as they pop into your mind, so I encourage you to do so. For those of you who may have been dialing in by the phone only and are not accessing the PowerPoint through the webinar, please know that we will allow time for you to ask questions via phone once the presentation is concluded. And we'll try to get to everyone's questions because this is quite a wonderful program and is receiving national recognition. I think you will soon understand why. We are going to kick it off by handing it over to Dr. Swaminathan to set the framework for this work. And with that, Swami, you
thank you, Rebecca, and thank you all for joining in this afternoon and share with you the excitement we feel when we have done this work the last few years. So before my co-presenter, Sherry, gives you the details of what we refer to as the MICS program, M-I-C-C-S, I want to just sort of lay the foundation for where we were when we approached our MICS program. So Illinois Masonic, as I've indicated in my handout, is a mid-sized community hospital, about 300 beds, med-surg, psychiatry. We have a 35-bed inpatient psychiatric unit and a full continuum of services. We have a 24/7 crisis program staffed by LCSWs, lots of trainees, both PhD and master's level social work, which is rotated by students and residents also. Also, we have a constant liaison service, which is staffed by an attending psychiatrist. We have a team, and we have professionals that support that team too. And then we have a full, complete service outpatient program across the street, which is one of the larger community mental health centers in the area, which is a hospital-based. It's sort of sponsored by the hospital. All our physicians and associates are fully employed by the hospital, so it's a staff model phenomenon. We are responsible for these folks doing the work. Our service area is interesting. We are in the middle of a large area of psychiatric intermediate care facilities. We call them halfway houses or psychiatric nursing homes. This came in the 60s and 70s as a result of the state-operated facilities deinstitutionalization program, where we let patients go to the streets and we sort of take care of them. They live in the nursing homes, but we service these nursing homes when they need psychiatric admissions. We also are a police drop-off area, so we get a lot of our business from people being brought to the emergency room for one reason or the other, psychiatric decompensations. And, of course, I have to tell you that the last few years has been very challenging in the state. There's been a great deal of funding sources being cut off by both the legislature as well as the governor's office. In the last 5 or 6 years, we've seen money disappearing from services provided for alcohol and substance use, certainly for chronic mental illness. So one of the things that we've faced is an increased utilization of our emergency room as a result of that. A few years ago, we had a much more serious issue with emergency room boarding, which we still have to some extent, but the state-operated facilities closures was a devastating feeling for most of the providers in this area. Now, before we got to mix, the problem of readmissions has been something we've been struggling with for the past maybe 7 to 10 years, and obviously something that I've been personally involved in terms of monitoring it. And so over the years, we've developed some programs that I want to just talk a little bit about. And that is, we do have a weekly staffing that's been going on for about 5 or 7 years now, where we specifically devote time to readmissions within 30 days. So the inpatient medical director, the senior social work staff, and the nursing staff get together and look over each case that's been readmitted within 30 days, specifically looking at why it happened, what failed in the outpatient, what could we do better, et cetera. In addition, we established about 6 or 7 years ago a program which involved our community stakeholders. So we have a large number of people, mental health centers that participate in our inpatient program that bring patients to us. And so we started to include them in our weekly staffings, and particularly the day before discharge, we have them visit on the unit with our patient and help us identify some of the concerns of possible readmission. So that's another thing that been very, very helpful in cutting back readmissions. But perhaps the most important one is our recognition from some of the old Joint Commission work that the longer the delay between discharge from the hospital and the first appointment, the higher the chances of readmission and noncompliance. This is a very compelling national statistic that we've been thinking about. So a few years ago, we established the First Access Program. And what this is was an opportunity for patients to be seen pretty much the same day as they make the call. We also utilize the First Access service to have patients that are discharged from the inpatient unit with a warm handoff walked over to the First Access program to be seen the very same day. They meet their therapist, they're introduced to the program as such, and within a short period of time they get to see a psychiatrist as a follow-up. So it's a very tight handoff from the inpatient. We use the same principles both for patients discharged from the emergency room and the CL program, so that patients are seen almost on the day of discharge from the hospital. Highly effective program. Our outpatient compliance in terms of intakes really skyrocketed, went upwards, and also helped us reduce readmissions. What it didn't do much for were those patients that kept coming back from the community because of lack of housing, lack of compliance to outpatient treatment, need for more court-mandated sort of procedures. And those patients just kept coming back, so they just somewhat could not respond to the weekly staffings and the participation by the community stakeholders and the First Access program. So we turned to think about what else could be done, and that's when I think we came along with the mixed program, which my friend and co-presenter and colleague Sherry Rickert will begin her conversation on. Sherry, you want to take it from there and talk to us about the mixed program? Thank you.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you, Tony. I just want to add to the First Access program. One of the things that I think makes it unique and successful is that we actually do a warm handoff from the hospital upon discharge. And so if a patient's being discharged from our psychiatric unit, our medical floor, our emergency room, the community mental health center is on our campus physically. And so a staff member will walk that patient across the street and introduce them to an engagement specialist in the outpatient clinic, and the engagement specialist will hook them up with a therapist, the therapist will look at all the medical charts that we had in the hospital, do a very brief intake with 10 minutes of assessment, 10 minutes of treatment intervention, and 10 minutes of making sure they have the right care plan, connecting the patient to groups and programming that week or maybe that same day. And so I used to joke that there was a giant pothole in our street because we had this really great program, but patients couldn't get there. And I think having this warm handoff has helped them really increase in being successful and getting to the next step of care. But for the mixed patients, the patients that we're talking about today, that's the 3 to 5% of patients that everybody has tried to treat. And they continue to come to the emergency room 50 times, 100 times, 300 times, and even more in some cases. And nobody has figured out how to treat them. They've not been hooked, they've not connected with the right services in the community. They refuse to. They might not have insight. They might not have the executive functioning to navigate the pieces that they need to do. And so we have to do something very creative and different for them. And so what we have created, it started in the spring of 2014, and it's a little bit different than some of the other community support teams in that it's medically integrated in the team. So the team members that are on this team would be a psychiatrist, a clinical social worker, a nurse, a chaplain, a case manager, and a prosumer. So either an employee that is a consumer who's had mental health experience, or it could be a volunteer that has had a history of mental health issues that is now helping support the individuals that we treat. The mission is to provide community-based treatment for our most complex behavioral health patients. And so these are typically patients that have a combination of a significant medical issue, 1, 2, 3 significant medical issues, in addition to depression, bipolar, schizophrenia. Next slide, please. So how do we identify our target patients? We look for the top 100 patients that have visited our emergency room, the patients that come most frequently. And in order to do that, they're just the most complex patients. And so we look at 30-day readmissions. We look at long length of stay. So if somebody makes it up onto our medical floor and has been treated by the consult liaison team, but they've been there for a really long time because something very serious has brought them to the hospital, and we think that it's going to be very difficult to get them connected correctly in the community, we look at those patients. We look at individuals that have had a decline in their outpatient functional status. So individuals that maybe haven't been captured yet as the top 100 in the emergency room, but we've identified them in the community mental health center as somebody who, you know, has been functioning with schizophrenia for the last 15 years, but now all of a sudden they have diabetes, COPD, and we're anticipating that they're going to be having more hospital visits, and so we want to intervene before they start to become more ill. So we're looking at the primary diagnosis of chronic mental illness and then anything that is attached to that, any comorbid medical condition. So like maybe an example of a patient that we would look at with a long length of stay that would be a significant risk. We had a young man, and it was his first episode of psychosis, and he had jumped from a window of another building and was significantly injured, had fractures. He was in the hospital for months and months and months, did not have any insight into his illness. It was the first episode of this kind, and really was not going to connect to services. And so for this particular individual, we mandated treatment, and we connected him to treatment, knowing that if he came into the hospital, if he did something similar and didn't get treatment, he could possibly die. And with the mandated treatment, we were able to keep him healthy. He was getting injections, and to keep him out of the hospital and stable. And so those are the individuals that we're looking at with a long length of stay actually on the medical campus. The caseload matrix. So we have on the team that I had identified, we keep about 20 patients per team member. We find that if there's more than 20 patients for each team member, that it's too difficult. The work that they're doing with these individuals is very detailed and complex and patient-centered because these are patients that the typical plan has not worked for. And so we really break down the case and tear it apart and look at, you know, what has not worked, why isn't it working, what do we really need to do differently. You know, if we have a patient who absolutely denies, I have no mental illness, there's nothing wrong with me, and we all see it a little bit differently, we look at which individual on the treatment team might have the most success in engaging with the patient, and we really utilize them as the first point of contact. We had one lady who had come to the emergency room over and over and over, and we knew that she was psychotic, and we knew that she had some delusions, but she refused meeting with a crisis clinician in the emergency room upon every visit. And she wasn't sick enough that she needed to be in the hospital, but she was sick enough that she was coming to the emergency room repeatedly. And so we asked one of the crisis workers to talk with her about, you know, what her spirituality was, what her other, you know, what helped her. And she agreed to meet with a chaplain. And the chaplain was actually her secret weapon because while she would not let any healthcare provider come to her house because she didn't identify with a mental illness, she was more than happy to let a chaplain come to her home. And that's how we initially engaged her and got her involved in services so that we could start doing the other non-traditional work that might help her. So we kind of have a 50-50 rule. It's when you're looking at the mixed team patients that we carry, they actually pay for themselves. The amount of money that they're costing hospital systems when they come back to the hospital over and over and over is huge. And so one single patient can actually pay for the mixed team. But because we have a complex system of billing, we also go ahead and do look at ways to support the service financially and other ways. And so we may, if they're a Medicaid patient, we do bill for services. If they're a patient that we can bill for services, we absolutely do. And so we look at a 50-50 kind of rule. So we're looking at the risks when we're deciding whether or not a patient can be a mixed team patient. We're looking at the recidivism. So in one month period, have they been there 3 times? In a 6 month period, have they been to the hospital in 6 times? We're looking for the risk of readmission. You know, what is the problem? Is it going to bring them back right away if they don't get the right care, like the man I had described earlier, or is it somebody that's going to connect in a traditional way and be okay? We look at the comorbidity and the complexity. You know, how difficult is it for them to navigate in the general community? And then we pay attention to the referral source. If Dr. Swami Nathan sends me a patient, I absolutely know that it's probably a patient that we need to follow up with. And so who's actually asking? Is it a physician in the emergency room that is really familiar with this patient and sees this as a significant problem? We look at the encounters indicated, so how many times have they been in the emergency room. And we also pay attention to their show rate because as we're balancing patients that are really incredibly hard to catch with patients that we know that are softer, that we can catch, and that helps with our payer combination, we do a combination of both of those patients paying attention to help support ourselves. Next slide, please. So in the hospital system, another way that we look for source of referrals is we have a quarterly report, Rand, that tells us who in the emergency room has had the most visits. And we really aim at the top 100 patients and go through their charts. Some of these patients are impossible to catch. Some of the patients are so sick that they actually may die before we're able to intervene. We've had some patients that we've lost from the mixed team. But a lot of the patients we are absolutely able to help. So we look at the quarterly report. We monitor readmission lists on a weekly or daily basis. Individuals that have come into the hospital, we can look into the medical system and see if they've been here. We get a lot of referrals from inpatient psychiatry. We have a very low rate on our inpatient psychiatric unit for recidivism, but if we do have a patient that's come to the inpatient psychiatric unit more than twice, we're absolutely looking at the case and evaluating. Physician requests. First access, where we are doing the handoff and receiving the patients, is another area that we might spotlight and identify that this patient has not had a lot of success in follow-up and looks fairly vulnerable, and so they may need to be attached to mix. Within the outpatient behavioral health environment, again, we're looking at patients that we think might be deteriorating. So we find the patients, but then how are we actually going to keep track of the patients when they come to the hospital? That's tricky. And so there's a couple different things that we've done. We have care plans in our emergency records. So there's alerts placed in the electronic chart. And so if a patient comes in and they've been identified as a mixed team candidate or if they're on our watch list, there will be a little red box that appears with the care plan in it that tells the staff, please contact the mixed team coordinator. This patient has been approved by psychiatry to get an injection in the emergency room, whatever the care plan is. And so there's alerts placed in the electronic chart. We have a 24/7 crisis team that is very active, and they frequently are identifying these patients. They carry the watch list, and so they're also looking to identify any patient that might not have a care plan yet but might be a good candidate because of the recidivism. We look at natural supports and system providers. So, again, if there's somebody in the system that's asked for it, we absolutely will follow through. One of the unique things that our patients do is they actually, some of them carry flash drives with medical alerts. And so if they decide that our emergency room is not a good place because we're paying so much attention to them and they wander across the city to another hospital and they come in and they share their medical alert, it will actually identify what, you know, we're doing with them and how they can reach us and what our recommendations are. And we have some patients that are actually pretty proud of their medical flash drives and carry them, and we've been contacted by multiple emergency rooms throughout the city. Next slide, please. So the goal of the mixed team is really something very different than treating a patient in the hospital. We're really working outside of the four walls, and so this is a behavioral health community-based treatment team. So we are out in the community. We are in the medical campus. We are following the patient anywhere that the patient goes. One of the things that we always try not to do is to duplicate community services. And so if a patient has something in place that's working, we don't want to spend time, you know, reworking or redoing that piece. We only want to identify what's not working and really support those areas for the patient. And we really look as a goal at utilizing carefully measured stepped care. And so with stepped care, we're always starting with engagement and education. I'm really trying to build a relationship with the patient, and we try to build that relationship with the patient by using the very best person on the team that we think, based on the patient's profile, will easily connect to that patient. And so it all starts with engagement and education. But with population health and with stepped care, we're always looking at whether or not we succeeded with that step. And so we do a very dynamic assessment and documentation of risks and needs, really going through the chart and saying, you know, what has failed, what's wrong with this patient? And so we're monitoring, you know, the patient is not working with us necessarily, but this is continuing to be a problem. We're doing a very comprehensive, integrated treatment and linked to all stakeholders. So if there's a primary care physician in the community, we're connecting with that primary care physician. We're looking to outreach to their natural supports. And natural supports can be absolutely anywhere. We had one individual who had a really high rate of recidivism, and we were working very closely with him to get him housing because it would have made a huge difference for his medical problems. And, of course, on the day that we were supposed to secure the housing and have him work with one of the local agencies that we work closely with, he was MIA, missing in action. And we knew that he hung out at the park, and so two of the team members actually went out to the park and met with his homeless buddies and said, hey, we'll give you guys bagel breakfast if you can find him and get him to this appointment on time. They rallied around the patient and were able to get him into his appointment. We were able to secure housing for him that day, and then it was just very easy to get him hooked up to the other services that he needed once he was stabilized in that way.
I just wanted to add something that Sherry just briefly talked about, and the notion of following the patient where the patient goes. One of our frustrations has been patients who get discharged to shelters frequently get no care and ended up coming back to the hospital. And the traditional ACT teams by our neighboring community mental health centers have actually failed in helping us. And there's a patient that I back in the days when I had a lot of fire practice, took care of for many, many years. This man came, paranoid schizophrenic, came to the hospital 10, 12, 15, 30 times a year. And Sherry's team and our mixed team picked him up from the shelter and not only participated in making sure he got his long-acting medications at the shelter, would actually take him to his housing appointments. And finally, at the end of 1 month, we're able to secure permanent housing. Lack of housing has been a big deal for my patients in the hospital and our patients in the community. And Sherry's team, sticking with the patient, getting the medications in, monitoring, observing, and then taking him to his housing appointments was a huge satisfier. This man has not come back for almost a year back to the hospital because he's got stable housing and stable outpatient treatment, again, thanks to the mixed team.
Thank you. And so so absolutely working with all of the stakeholders. Other tools that we use when we're measuring the stepped care is looking at the mental health declaration. It's a really powerful tool, and it really engages the patient and empowers them to make a decision when they are stable about what they would want if they become more ill. It's a legal document, and it really has helped us to help patients follow through when they might not be thinking as clearly. I think if you're talking about changing habits, we know that it takes us quite a while to change a habit, and the average length of stay on a psychiatric unit might be 5 to 7 days. Is that accurate, Dr. Swaminathan? And so that doesn't necessarily give you the time to change a habit, even if the medication is making you feel better. And so once a patient clears, we make it a standard practice for mixed patients to do a mental health declaration if they're willing, so that if they decide that they no longer want that injection, we have the power to go back and say, yes, but you said you would get that injection. And so if you don't get the injection, we are going to take you back, and we are going to rework this to help you get better. We have another great story, and I think stories are actually the best way to kind of describe the success of the mixed team. We had a young man who was very, very ill, was in the hospital. He did a mental health declaration while he was stable in the hospital right before discharge. And upon his first visit to see his psychiatrist in the outpatient clinic, said, absolutely not. I changed my mind. No way am I getting that injection. And so the psychiatrist came in to the mixed team and said, oh, no, what are we going to do? And we started looking at how quickly we thought he would decompensate. Do we need to send the police out to his home? We don't want to scare him. How can we best help him? And so the suggestion was that actually this was a very religious man, that we would send the nurse out and the chaplain out, and they would meet with him and his family to discuss his decision about this injection. And so the nurse took the mental health declaration, and the chaplain went out and talked with him and prayed with him and his family about what they might want and what might be helpful. And he actually agreed to get the injection, and the entire family came together and, like, prayed at the end, and we're all so happy. Mom was crying, and he successfully continued with those injections and has not returned to the hospital in over a year.
The other thing that Sherry was talking to the team about the other day is we have a new initiative that we have been able to work through with the legal community in Chicago, which is called an agreed-upon order. This is a document that is really not binding, such as a court-mandated order. It's a document that the patient signs on the last day or a couple of days before discharge from the hospital, where he agrees to the regimen prescribed by the staff and the physician at the hospital. It's actually sent to the court. The court puts its seal, and it makes it sound like a legal document that is sort of binding. The mixed team has used it very successfully in being able to continue long-acting medications in the community. And we have an interesting story of a patient at our mixed staffing 2 weeks ago where the patient's agreed-upon order, which is usually 90 days, actually ended. And at which point, Sherry's team went up to him and said, you know, you're not mandated by the court to take this medicine anymore. And his response was, I kind of like the way it makes me feel. I'm going to take it anyway. And again, a story of an involvement and engagement by the mixed team on a continuum to the level that the patient begins to engage, not so much as an adversary, but more as a partner in the mental health treatment.
And just too quickly, two other way tools that we use within the stepped care process is something called five wishes. And it's really something that you might think of if you were thinking about a hospice patient. But one of the things to consider is that if you have a patient who has significant substance abuse issues and really is drinking maybe to help with the symptoms of mania and has never been compliant with medication. They might be getting dialysis now. They're really, really sick, and they're not changing their behaviors. We actually have the chaplain meet with all of our patients that are very medically ill with a psychiatric symptom, ruling out, of course, anybody that would have suicidality or would have any issues with cutting kinds of behaviors. But if we have a straight patient that really isn't confused with our sick or depressed patients, we go ahead and we talk with them about the five wishes, and we plan in a very purposeful way around what a dignified death would look like. It sounds a little unusual, but the tools that you have to use with these types of patients are very unusual. And so we talk in a very supportive way around, you know what, it sounds like, you know, you're not making the right choices. And if I'm understanding from the physician that if you continue to make these choices, you are going to die. And if you are going to die, you know, we need to have these five wishes in place. We need to have them scanned into the chart so that if you come into the hospital, you know, and you're coding or whatever is going on with you, we can actually follow through and do what you would want us to do. And so we use the five wishes. And under MIX is also the umbrella for first episode of psychosis. And so MIX is really focused on the patients that have failed all treatments. But at the same time, we're now trying to catch the patients that are just entering the system so that we can prevent them from becoming a MIX patient in the future, with really giving them hope and understanding mental illness in a different way. Next slide, please. Interventions are really about engagement and measurement. And so we are always working to engage the patient. What I call it for my team are carrots. You know, what is it that we're going to give the patient that will really help them to feel good? Do we need to work with them on, you know, having a therapy animal? You know, what is it that they need from us that will help them connect to us? And if we can do that, then we move them through in unusual ways. But at the same time, we're always measuring the severity of the illness. And so, you know, you can have a patient that says, I'm going to do all of these things, but if they've been there 40, 50, 500 times, they're really showing you that they can't do that. And as the severity is evident to us, we document their inability to care for self and their inability to make good decisions and really try to treat them then with a more mandated type of treatment, as Dr. Swaminathan was talking about. So it really takes an incredible amount of creativity, really paying attention to their needs, and the team is really tenacious in continuing to follow them and take care of them. We actually met with a patient at 4 o'clock in the morning this past week. We've been working with him for 6 months, getting him to a reservation where he would get the right substance abuse treatment. And it was very successful, but it just took us probably many, many months to get him to agree. Next slide, please. So one of the big questions is, what is the difference between traditional community teams and the mixed team? And they actually are, they might sound the same as a mental health community support team in the community, but there is a lot of difference. So for a traditional community support team, an ACT team, a CST team, they usually offer 1 to 3 visits per week. The mixed team really measures where that patient's at and what they need, and that patient may get 1 to 5 visits per day or month, depending on what they need. If we have a patient that's non-compliant with their medication and we think we're engaging them, we will call that patient every single morning or 3 times a day and say, okay, it's 3 o'clock. Did you take your medicine today? And work with them. And so it's very, very a lot of attention to detail and working specifically with that patient. For traditional community teams, there's a lot of emphasis on engagement. Engagement is absolutely the way to reach the patient. However, and for the mixed team, we start with engagement, and we always believe engagement is powerful and we want to respect the patient's autonomy. But at the same time, we don't want to allow a patient that's illness is so significant that it's interfering with their basic needs to continue to be sick. And so we will expand those tools to mandated treatment if we see that it's really probably not very humane to let them continue on the path that they are currently on. Traditional community teams are outsourced. So there's a community team and they bring it into the hospital. Our team is, all of our employees are hired by the hospital, and that gives us 100% mobility. And so the mixed team members, they will come into the emergency room and do the evaluation themselves if the patient's there. They will go to the medical floor and they will talk to the trauma physician if the patient is upstairs. They will go, they will take the patient home to their house. They work with our outpatient sites. They are using the same communication platforms and the same record keeping as all of the in-house staff. And so it makes it very, very easy to have great communication. Traditional community support teams often have coverage that's 9 to 5. They might not have holiday coverage. They might not have weekend coverage. Our mixed team is an extension of our 24/7 crisis team. And so we have coverage always. We're always able to outreach to these patients and to work with these patients if needed. A traditional community support team might have MD appointments where they're scheduled to meet with a physician, or the physician may even be scheduled to go into their home and the patient's not there. What we're using on the mixed team is really telehealth for the MD. And so we have our clinicians out in the field, and if this has been a patient that our psychiatrist has been trying to reach but hasn't been able to, they will pull them up on their laptop. We have HIPAA-compliant telepsych where we can actually pull our psychiatrist up anytime we want and say, hey, Dr. Butch, you know, we've got this patient here. We know you prescribed this medication. They're saying that they're sleeping way too much. Can I pull them up and can you take a look at them and have a conversation with them and tell us what you would recommend to be different, and then we can go ahead and make that happen that day. For a traditional community support team, you have assigned case managers, so one person is following that patient, and that's great, except sometimes you need a more of a community approach. And so we have very fluid use of staff. We will use one staff member if they're working, but if that's not working, the minute that it shows it's not working, we pull somebody else in. Three or four different staff members from different disciplines may be meeting with a patient the same day. Next slide, please. I'm just kind of going through our wins and just kind of talk about, you know, well, how do you fund something like this? How do you fund something like this? It's really a question of how do you not fund something like this if you start looking at the numbers. And so this individual, the first one on the win, John in his mid-50s, history of schizoaffective disorder, alcohol abuse, long-term homelessness, incredible amount of emergency room visits, 81 visits, two that required a medical admission. If you look at the cost on the slide, it's absolutely outstanding, $155,000. And we worked with this patient. We actually found out this individual had he was homeless. His mother had died a year ago, and he just couldn't navigate all the things that he needed to do in the community. So because he had such a comorbid condition, we were actually able to place him in housing fairly quickly. This individual now volunteers in a cat shelter. He's been out of the hospital for maybe, I don't know, 1 or 2 years. We've decreased the amount of visits that he needs. We have him hooked up to all kinds of natural supports, including spiritual supports in the community, and he's doing outstanding. Another individual, the 81-year-old, he had been coming to the emergency room almost on a daily basis, a regular basis, depression, anxiety, alcohol. We really tried to stabilize him and engage him in his apartment. He just could not do it. And in those intimate conversations that we were having with him, we found out that he had a brother that was in another nursing home. And we were able to convince him that maybe it was time for him to move into a nursing home with his brother. And he did, and we've not seen him since. In fact, when I was doing a follow-up call to check on the status of our mixed patients, I thought that he might have passed away because we hadn't seen him in such a long time. But he's actually doing very, very well in the nursing home.
Thank you, Sherry. I just wanted to add a couple of things over here in terms of our success. Our readmission rate for the psychiatric behavioral health unit is around 5% or less. The state average for public aid is about 12 to 15%, and we have about 35, maybe 40% public aid or Medicaid admissions. But we've had reasonable success fairly consistently in the last 3 or 4 years where we've held that number steady. And considering the population, the police drop-offs, the community of severely chronically mentally ill people, the degree of homelessness, the degree of lack of funding for outpatient sources, and the compliance issues being paramount, we think the combination of the First Access, the mixed program, and our traditional methods have done a great job in cutting back on readmissions in psychiatry. But perhaps most importantly, about 4 or 5 months ago, and I sit on the hospital performance improvement quality committee, And I got a call from our quality improvement president of the committee, our chairman of the committee, who specifically said, we need to move MIC's program out of behavioral health into general medicine. And I think this is, in my opinion, where the action is that the hospital loses a great deal of money and there's high recidivism in medical patients who get admitted with congestive failure, emphysema, poorly controlled diabetes, who keep going out and coming back in because their comorbid psychiatric conditions, i.e. depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, has not been adequately addressed. So the hospital has asked us to partner with them in a combined effort to identify these patients when they come back and they're readmitted to the medical floor, to work with them and start the journey right there and continue doing the same kind of work we do in the community with these patients through our mixed efforts. I think this is a huge opportunity for us, really a lot of promise that we look forward to, and hopefully a year from now we'll come back and tell you how successful we are. I want to end the program. Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in.
Wow, how inspirational. We've got a number of questions that have come in online, and we will get to those. I first want to offer the opportunity, operator, if you could tell those people who may have been only able to dial in via the phone to participate, please give them the instructions as to how to queue up for a question.